Laura, can I ask you something personal?
Always.
Are you sure?
Yeah, Leah, of course. Go ahead.
Has your data been breached?
That is the personal question. I thought you were going to ask me, like, how often I shower or
Oh
something.
my God. I mean, what could be more personal than your personal information falling into the hands of, I don't know, nefarious actors?
I guess it's just the data breach doesn't really sound like a personal problem. It sounds more like a tech issue. You know what I mean?
Oh, it's personal. I'm talking about like your address, your social security number, your baby's birthday.
Okay, leave my baby out of this.
Okay, but think about it. Every day you just spread your personal data all over town with hardly a second thought.
Leah, what kind of person do you think I am?
It's not just you, Laura. We all do it. We share information about ourselves with banks, credit card companies, our doctors, our schools, and we assume that it's secure. Take UC Berkeley, for instance. Tens of thousands of students, teachers, and staff entrust the university with their personal info. You know, because you have to submit that stuff when you apply and register or when you set up your tax info with HR or whatever. And all that data is stored somewhere.
Yeah, hopefully somewhere safe, like in a safe behind a painting.
Well, but it's all digitized. So instead of a safe behind a painting, it's more like a computer with encryption.
You've totally lost me.
Okay. How about we do this with a story?
Great. Now you're talking my language. This is The Edge, a podcast produced by California Magazine and the Cal Alumni Association,
where we bring in UC Berkeley experts to talk about ideas on the cutting edge and a few that go too far.
In this episode, we're going to find out just how cyber insecure we are and what, if anything, we can do to protect ourselves. I'm your host, Laura Smith.
And I'm also your host, Leah Worthington.
This episode of The Edge is brought to you by Wine Access. Join the Wine Access Wine Club at wineaccess.com/cal to receive $25 off your first two shipments. That's right, $25 off on each of your first two shipments by visiting wineaccess.com/cal and signing up.
Okay, so in December of 2015, some hackers broke into the UC Berkeley financial system and accessed the personal data of 80,000 people. All of a sudden, the social security numbers, bank data, and other info from students, employees, vendors, etc., was in the hands of dark web tech pirates.
Whoa, that does not sound good.
Yeah, it was a really big deal.
So how did they get the data? I assume they didn't, like, break in and steal computers, right?
Well, funny you should ask, that actually did happen at UC Berkeley, but that was a few years later, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. In this case, though, you're right. They didn't grab the computers. Basically, there was a flaw in the financial system software, and Berkeley actually knew about it and was working on fixing it when the attackers exploited the weakness.
Those jerks, they totally caught us with our pants down.
It's true. And it was a huge security headache. The university had to provide everyone with identity theft monitoring, identity theft insurance, and then, of course, they had to fix the software. And it wasn't the first time. In 2009, hackers made off with the data of 160,000 Cal students, alums, and others.
Oh, no.
In that case, the breach wasn't discovered for like 6 months, so the hackers had access to all of the data for that entire time. And
really, there's more?
In 2005, a guy just walked in and swiped a laptop that had personal data for over 100,000 students. Although, in this case, the university says they got it back before the info could be taken.
Okay, small victory.
6 months before that, hackers got access to Berkeley research that had the data of 600,000.
Okay, I'm done. This is just far too much hacking. But seriously, if Berkeley, a massive research institution with some of the world's leading info security experts, is vulnerable to cyber attacks, then what's the hope for someone like me?
I know. But okay, before you lose all hope, I do have an idea that might make you feel a little bit better.
Oh yeah, what's that?
Okay, what if we treated our online health the same way that we treat our physical health? So think of it like this. Just like our bodies, our digital selves need regular maintenance to stay healthy. We go in for checkups, we immunize ourselves against dangerous bugs.
Okay, I think I see where you're going with this. Hackers are like viruses that damage your online immune system, leaving you vulnerable to worse illness like credit card fraud.
If we think of our virtual selves as something that you have to take care of proactively, in the same way that you might go to the doctor for a checkup, there are actually some pretty simple things you could do to make sure that you're at peak online health.
Okay, so how do you do that?
Well, I know a magical place filled with benevolent hackers who I think can help us figure this out.
Okay, so do you guys want to introduce yourselves?
Yeah, I'm Steve Trush. I am the Deputy Director of the Citizen Clinic here at UC Berkeley's Center for Long-Term Cybersecurity.
And I'm Sean Brooks, the Director of the Citizen Clinic.
Oh, yeah, we forgot to introduce Ralphie.
Hey, Ralphie.
Ralphie is a really cool-looking dog. Like, he looks like the creature from Neverending Story.
Oh, my God, he does.
Yeah, I know.
Ralphie is the Citizen Clinic mascot.
So the Citizen Clinic is a public interest security clinic at UC Berkeley that works with politically vulnerable and low resource groups. So think journalists, human rights organizations, nonprofits, groups that might be targeted for online harassment or malware or security breaches, but don't have the financial resources to protect themselves.
And my first question is, who are these hackers anyway? Like, personally, I'm picturing, like, masked guys in an abandoned arcade, maybe somewhere on Coney Island.
Do you get all your information from Mr. Robot?
No comment. Back to the experts.
When you look at big corporate email hacks, talking about hundreds of millions of addresses, I mean, by and large, these are members of organized crime groups. Sometimes you'll hear about sort of big breaches done by activists or by, you know, people doing it for the lulz, just, you know, trying to make a point. By and large, those are sort of less insidious.
I imagine that hackers aren't going after individual people one by one unless they have some reason to.
Yeah. One of the things we tell our students a lot is that all attackers have a boss and a budget. And those things mean different things to different attackers, right? That budget might not necessarily be money, but it could be time.
So what would you be, like, most worried about someone finding?
I'd be worried about, like, bank information.
I also would be super pissed if my social was available online. Because that seemed, you guys are kind of smirking.
I mean, the reality is that social security numbers are available really widely for everybody. I mean, it's a really commonly breached piece of information. And it's, and one of the reasons is that it can't change, right?
Right.
Is that, you know, you have an email address, it gets compromised. If you feel like it's super unsafe, you get a new email address. The things that can't change, your birth date, your social security number, you know, those things get out there and it's really hard, if not impossible, to kind of claw them back.
Speaking of things that get out there, passwords. According to Steve, we've been doing passwords all wrong. How bad is it if my password is the exact same for everything?
Really bad. That's probably the worst thing.
Oh, God. Oh, I don't do that.
Asking for a friend.
Yeah.
What about, like, not the same, but like a pattern?
Not the same, but a pattern. So, like, you know, common things are, like, you change the last number, mm-hmm. or like, you add some, like, punctuation at the end of it, things like that. That's also pretty bad. If I knew what the root of your password was, I can easily write a script that can try out, you know, adding numbers to the end of it or adding different combinations of punctuation.
You know, there's a concept for password strength, right, about entropy.
The general idea is that as you increase the complexity or entropy of your passwords by using a longer, more varied string of characters, you increase the number of attempts it would take for an attacker to break it.
So then we should all change our passwords to super long, complicated things like XYZ exclamation mark period dot asterisk, right?
If you can't say it, it can't be your password.
That's a really great rule.
Generally, a strong password doesn't get you very far. You can have a strong password. It is a good thing to have, but given the frequency at which they're breached and frankly how, like, bad of a tool they are, right? Because passwords are hard to remember. It's hard to remember a lot of them. It's hard to constantly be using them and logging in. So we develop lots of shortcuts because generally they're a very bad tool.
How would someone know that they're, oh God, they're smiling.
They just opened up their laptops.
So we've been talking about sort of going after your accounts by finding your passwords, right? But honestly, the easiest way to get access to someone's account is for them to just give it to you, right? And so what you would do is send a phishing email. The best way to send a phishing email is with sort of targeted information about that person that is really tailored to their interests. So that's called a spear phishing email. So if I wanted to send you a spear phishing email, maybe I would look for your Spotify account and send you something that looks like an email from Ticketmaster and say, hey, there are a few last minute tickets available to this band that it seems like you're listening to a lot recently. You know, do you want to buy tickets? Send you to a page that looks like a Ticketmaster login and have you log in with your credentials there. I can use those credentials to see if I can get access to something else.
Okay, but sometimes the phishing emails are a little less friendly. Sometimes, rather than prey on our interests, they prey on our fears.
A really famous example from the 2016 attacks on the DNC is the email that sort of got John Podesta was a sort of a Google account security email, which was, someone from Ukraine has logged into your email, click here to reset your password. Those types of urgent things, it really bypasses a lot of our ability to kind of sort of think rationally and be like, well, is this real? Very famously, John Podesta also did actually question the legitimacy of that email and sent it to his IT team, and they said it was legitimate and sent him he clicked on the thing after that. There's lots of different techniques, but the goal is to be something benign enough so that it's not suspicious, or to use one of these social engineering techniques to get you to sort of ignore warning signs and just kind of dive in.
I see. So instead of you having to do all the work, you just manipulate me so that I give you everything you need.
Right.
Great. That makes sense. So should we talk more about what you guys can find on us?
I think the next thing I would probably do is, if I was trying to find your physical addresses, I would look at finding who your parents are and look at their kind of social media profiles.
Yeah, let's find your parents.
My parents.
Looking back at historical photos also, people forget what they post. I found one, Laura, on your Twitter page, which appears to be a bunch of parking tickets. The image is not high quality enough for me to see any of the information on these parking tickets, but I was really hoping that I would get something from that, because I could have gotten license plate number, VIN number. That would have been pretty good.
With fancy software, would you be able to extract information from a photo like that?
I don't know. I have my doubts that we'd get anything from this. It doesn't look like a very...
Just to be clear, there are how many parking tickets are on the car?
Five.
Yeah, I got five. I remember that day. It was such a bad
day. You got five
day.
In one day?
In one day. It was such a nightmare.
What the hell were you doing?
Just working. What's happening now?
So because you have a website that's registered to your name, I assume it belongs to you and you registered it, there are websites that I can look at the registration history and see if you put your physical address as well as your phone number.
Apparently, if you don't opt out of sharing that information and the website company isn't protecting themselves, that information is totally searchable.
Looks like it was registered in New York, but I can look through the history and see if that was always the case and whether something was leaked, such as...
oh my God.
A street address.
Old street address.
That was my apartment in New York.
Is this your current phone number?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be that.
There's a bunch of these data aggregators that are on the internet, and one of them is My Life, and they will have what they've gathered from other data sources. They'll buy information from the DMV, and they'll put together profiles. They're allowed to resell it to the data brokers.
The DMV? That is so whack.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's one of the ways they stay in business.
The Department of Motor Vehicles?
That seems, I don't know how all of this works, but since they're a federal agency, that seems really
state.
Questionable.
State. Yeah. State, each state has different laws around what is and isn't permissible.
There's a lot of information on that. First of all, they're so wrong about my net worth. I actually have a negative net worth.
Damn, look at your income.
And my income is very wrong.
Did you see that your home is worth $625?
I know. I'm curious what that even means. What does that mean? I mean, is that my car? Like, what's...
It's also a really good example of just how fundamentally unreliable a lot of this stuff is, yeah. Right? And people might be making decisions about you based on this, right? You know, if you're doing pre-employment screenings, background checks, a lot of these services sell this data as fairly authoritative, and clearly it's not.
Okay, quick pause. I have to say, Laura, no offense, but it does seem like you're putting out quite a bit of damaging information about yourself without any help from anyone else.
I know. At this point, Steve and Sean haven't even really tried that hard. They've looked through my social media profiles, done some Google searches, but I'm just giving my information away. But as Sean explained, maybe it's not even your fault. The world we live in is pressuring us to make our lives more and more public.
A lot of career paths now is people are told that they have to build a personal brand, they have to have an online presence so that they're findable, that they're identifiable not only by just information that they would share about themselves, but they have to have a personality associated with that. And in order to do that, we have to share things about ourselves and our lives that, at least in the past, might not have been accessible to people that we're professionally associated with.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me think of, I'm very afraid of being murdered. And I did this test online one time to find out what my odds were of being murdered. And a lot of the questions were like, do you run the same route all the time? And I was like, yes, I do. And it makes me think that the way I live online is sort of like I run the same route. I go to the same rehearsals. I go to the same workplace. I work in the same cafes. But it's also all accessible online. If I post a story on Instagram or I, you know, say, tag myself as going to an event or whatever, it's just so easy to map my route.
Well, he is very boring, so.
I'm just waiting to be murdered.
Yeah. She's trying to get murdered.
Okay, so I know we were sort of joking about the murder bit, but there is some truth to that. And it made us wonder, what's the worst case scenario when it comes to cyber attacks?
So my fear is that because I do write about white supremacy sometimes, and some of the people that I write about are quite dangerous, like they'll come to my house and like, I don't know, murder me.
Or they won't come to your house. They may spoof your phone number and call the police and say that there's a hostage situation at your home address and let the SWAT team come to your house.
Oh, God.
I mean, the reality is, I think also that the stakes are just higher for women, right? Women, yeah. Members of racial, religious, cultural minorities. And certainly for women journalists, there's been plenty of examples in the last couple of years of sort of sustained trolling campaigns, making it just fundamentally difficult to do your job. And so that is not necessarily a worst case scenario, but it is a highly likely scenario, particularly for someone who's reporting on white supremacy.
Sean says that the threat level can really vary from person to person, company to company, and that's something they work on assessing at the Citizen Clinic.
A lot of things that we work with our student teams when they're working with nonprofits is something called, you know, threat modeling, thinking about who the bad guy is and what the bad thing is specifically that we're worried about so that we can help the organizations that we work with, you know, spend the limited time and resources that they have to address those needs.
But for all of our listeners who are at home and might not have access to a professional, there are some things you can do on your own. Like if you want to figure out if you've been part of a large-scale data breach, there are some places you can check.
For example, if you go to haveibeenpwned.com, and pwned is spelled P-W-N-E-D, you can enter your email address and see a list of your accounts that have been part of cyber attacks.
So what this is a service run by a guy named Troy Hunt. And what he does is when there's a major breach, he'll get access to all of the breach data and scan basically all of the email addresses and then create like a giant archive of, okay, here's a searchable database of what breaches my information has appeared in.
What does that mean?
Here, like it says, you can check to see if your account has been compromised in a breach.
Do it. Did I get pwned?
So you just clicked on the pwn button and it says, oh no, you've been pwned.
Ah!
You were pwned on 9 breach sites.
And so Leah, you use the service Canva. In May of this year, that was breached. And so in that one, email addresses, geographic location, name, password, and username was released. Jeez. But your data also appeared in a number of other services.
This made me start to think, like, I've put my name and email addresses into so many different websites, and they're all potential entry points to my personal information. And I can't even honestly remember the names of most of them or why I even signed up in the first place.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, I bet most of us have. So then here we are with all of our passwords and email addresses scattered about the interwebs. And the question is, what, if anything, can we do about it?
I wouldn't even know where to begin with, you know, deleting accounts or resetting passwords for all of these random services.
So that's why we have a thing called password managers, which... if you've been around, you may have heard of them. But
Ken felt a little passive aggressive. I've heard of password managers and also those little like key things that...
A YubiKey?
YubiKey.
Yeah. I have a couple on my keychain.
Wait, so what is a YubiKey?
So a YubiKey is a form of multi-factor authentication.
It's just like a little something you keep on your keychain and plug right into your computer.
So let's say I'm trying to sign into Twitter from a computer that I don't normally use. After I type in my password, Twitter will prompt me to plug in my YubiKey and confirm that it's me.
And it makes your accounts much more difficult to hack because you need the actual physical thing in order to get in.
So I got to be honest, I think part of the barrier for me to being more cybersecure is that I don't actually feel that vulnerable. Like I feel aware that my information is vulnerable, but I don't really know. Like Laura said, I'm pretty boring. I don't make a ton of money. I don't see that there are things in my life that are that interesting to other people.
She's trying to throw people off the trail right now.
Don't look for me. There's nothing to find. But seriously...
Yeah, well, so I think there's like a basic level of cybersecurity practice that you should take regardless of what you think your adversaries and threats may be. And that's things like having the multi-factor authentication that we talked about, using a password manager, or at least using unique passwords on every site. And if you have to write them down in a book, that works for you. But using a VPN, a virtual private network, that's another just basic kind of hygiene where if we're talking about like, you know, safe sex, right? Like you wear a condom, you know, and it doesn't matter like who your partner necessarily is. You don't have to have like a threat profile every time. It's just like, okay, there are certain things that we do that we know are safer practices.
And to take that metaphor one step further, when you use a condom, you're not just protecting yourself from any potential STDs, you're also preventing transmission to all future partners.
There's like a herd immunity that we need to like encourage, where not only are you worried about yourself, but if someone was targeting you, they could also be targeting your family members. And that kind of raises the stakes.
We are all essentially the gateway to each other's information.
Okay, but Leah.
Yes, Laura.
So I'm making strong, unique passwords for every account I have, storing them in a secure password manager, and even using multi-factor authentication. But what do I do about all my data that's already out there?
That's such a good question. And, you know, I'd answer it, but I think Steve wants to.
It's really hard to deal with, like, this public information, like, our phone numbers and our addresses, because we give them to the, you know, DMV or utility companies, and some of that stuff is sold to other data brokers, which is resold. And so there's, if you go to privacyduck.com, there are lists of instructions on how to opt out of each and every one of these data brokers, and it is actually like a full-time job to do that.
You can pay someone to do that for you through some of these services, but if you want to show them how much this stuff costs.
Yeah, if you want the paid service, it is VIP privacy is $1,000 a year.
Just to pay someone to go through and opt out.
Which is more than the value of your home.
True. Laura, you're going to have to sell that tent and
sell
more.
My home and then come up with some extra money.
And so, you know, when people talk about privacy being a luxury good, this is kind of the example, right? Because sure, there are people who can afford this, but most of us can't.
So then, okay, most of us can't afford this. So what can most of us afford?
I would say each of you should make a list of like your most important accounts, such as both personal and work, and make sure that each of those accounts have strong, unique passwords.
If you can think of four generally unrelated words, toddlers are a great password generator. But four generally unrelated words, that's a pretty good password. You know, if you were trying to attack that with a computer, it would take a number of years to break that just by brute force. You know, it's much easier to remember, too, because you can write a little story in your head around that. It makes it a little more human-friendly.
Sean also reminded us to set up multi-factor authentication. That might include a YubiKey, a fingerprint, or even just a text message that we get on our phones.
And usually when you set up multi-factor authentication, it also turns on things like login alerts. So your phone will be notified that, hey, someone tried to log into your Google account. Was it you? And you know, most of the time it will be you and it will be fine. But if you get a strange alert, you'll know that either somebody has tried to access to your account or something strange is going on.
So I think would be important for you is to think of like your phone numbers and protecting that. So there are things like, you know, signing up for Google Voice and having a phone number that's tied to your actual phone number. So I use a phone number. It's called a VoIP number. That's essentially kind of like a made up phone number that will forward to my actual phone number, and no one knows like my actual phone number except for the phone company. Yeah.
I know. You're thinking, but I've had this same number since middle school. It's part of my identity. And actually, that's the whole problem. Phone numbers, passwords, email addresses, they are all a part of our identity, which means that if someone gets access to them, they can use them to access other more private parts of your identity as well.
You know, there are a lot of trade-offs. And I think that some of this is just the development of social norms that takes time for us to start understanding how attached are we to these specific phone numbers or these addresses, and how much friction are we willing to go through to change these things over time to kind of keep ahead of this.
The number one thing to remember is that these hackers prey on our fears and on our vulnerabilities. So if you notice something suspicious, don't just start wiring money to Kazakhstan. Also, ask yourself if you expected that email from Google or from your bank or from whoever. And if you didn't, be really suspicious about it. Definitely don't click on any links.
There's a common tactic of using a security alert as the phishing attempt. So for instance, you'll get an email saying from Facebook that, oh, there was a suspicious login attempt. You should change your password immediately. And those things I always take seriously, but I'll go to the website itself and I won't follow the links that are in the phishing email. If Facebook or Spotify or Google is saying that there's a suspicious activity, I'll go to, you know, Google, log in myself, go to the security settings and change my password.
That actually makes me feel good.
Yeah, I actually feel pretty good. I feel like I can find the four things that I want to manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this seems doable. I was feeling a little despondent at a certain point when we were looking at the cost of security.
We see a lot of, a friend of ours called it security nihilism with the organizations that we work with, right? Where it's just like there's so much scary stuff out there. And it's really hard to know where to start, to know if anything makes any difference. And it's really easy to just kind of throw up your hands and say, you know, what can I possibly do? Finding those little bite-sized chunks to make some meaningful progress can be very affirming and encouraging, and does, in fact, I mean, the things that we're talking about, better authentication security, will harden your online presence in a really meaningful fashion. It makes you a lot harder to compromise.
So how secure do you guys feel? How cybersecure do you feel on a scale of one to Mr. Robot?
Not. I mean, I think that part of it is the nature of the work that we do. I am just as susceptible to a good phishing email. You know, my information is out there just like it's out there about everybody else. And so we all have to operate at a certain level of assumed insecurity because of that.
So, Laura, you went back to the Citizen Clinic for your cybersecurity checkup.
Yeah, I got a password manager. I set up two-factor authentication on my phone, and I also got a YubiKey. And then I went through my social media and tried to remove anything that clearly stated where I lived, like an old Craigslist post or a wedding registry, you know, things like that.
So how do you feel? Do you actually feel more secure?
I mean, I definitely feel more secure, and I was surprised by how easy it was to do all of that. Now that I do it every day, it's just like one of the things that I do, and I don't think that much about it. But also at the same time, Learning more about this has made me think that no one is totally secure, and a lot of companies have my credit card information, and I'm just sort of trusting them that they're taking the precautions to prevent any major breaches, like what happened at Berkeley. It occurs to me that one thing I can do is make sure that I'm more careful with one-time transactions or account logins, like when I sign up for some random food delivery service and use one of my generic throwaway passwords.
Yeah, totally. I do that all the time. Hopefully no one is listening to this. So, should we hear from our neighborhood kid now?
Yep, here's Marco with the last word.
I just use the same password for everything, so I don't have to write it down.
Marco, that's bad. Did you know that? That you're supposed to have different passwords for everything?
No, but like, honestly, I'm just too lazy to really care.
This is The Edge, brought to you by California Magazine and the Cal Alumni Association. I'm Laura Smith.
And I'm Leah Worthington. This episode was produced by Kobe McDonald with support from Pat Joseph. Special thanks to Steve Trush, Sean Brooks, Brooke Coatman, California Magazine interns Grace Vogel and Stephen Ruscone, and of course, Ralphie the dog. Original music by Mowgli Morial. And for God's sake, change your password.